Radio Rakel dokumentar. Hver mandag klokka 5 og onsdag klokka 6 på Radio Rakel FM 99,3.
NEET-festivalen var den første innen sexpositivitet i Norge og fant sted 9.–11. november på Litteraturhuset. Med positiv seksualitet menes god seksuell helse, en positiv og respektfull tilnærming med fokus på seksualitetens betydning for fysisk, mental og sosial velvære. Dette er et bredt tema, og festivalen tok for seg et mangfold av dem under foredrag og workshops. Noen av disse foredragsholderne var jeg så heldig og fikk intervjue. I denne miniserien tar jeg for meg BDSM, mensseksualitet, grensesetting og seksualitet blant mennesker med intellektuell funksjonsnedsettelse og ikke minst polyamori gjennom 4 episoder. Mitt navn er Sara Ammerdalen, og dette er Radio Rakel dokumentar. I del 1 om polyamori diskuterte jeg med Linn Myrdal fra PolyNorge og Daniel Cardozo fra Lucifer University of Humanities and Sciences om hva polyamori er og hvordan det passer under paraplybegrepet consensual non-monogamies. Videre snakket vi feminisme og mononormativitet og deres aktivisme som polyamorøse. I denne delen av intervjuet går vi videre inn i sammenhengen mellom feminisme og polyaktivisme.
And do we have some sort of idea how many people are polyamorous?
Well, estimates are very thin because if a subject is said not to exist, then you don't collect information about it, then it doesn't exist. And so you see how that goes round and round and round.
And I guess also if people don't, as you said, you don't even know about this concept, so you can't even, like you said with gays also, like if you don't know the concept of gay, how can you like identify with anything that you don't know?
But some estimates that are mostly coming off of the United States and some Anglo countries are looking at around 5 to 10% of the population being consensually non-monogamous in some way, but, and this is a big but, some studies about what is usually called infidelity, sexual infidelity, put sexual infidelity rates, which is something different from consensual non-monogamies, some studies put it at 75% through your whole life. So monogamy, as we understand it, is a fiction.
Mm. Basically.
Okay, yeah, I guess we could say many reasons to like why that number is, but I guess it's some form of still some sort of proof that monogamy doesn't work.
It's also some studies then that show that, also from the States, that show that the number of people that think that they would like to live polyamorous or do it or have been doing it for some part of their life, the number is around 21%. So that research shows that, and the numbers are higher for people that are bisexual. If you are bisexual, research, not a lot of research, but the little we got, the little we got, shows that over 50% of people that are bisexual view living poly as the ideal way of doing relationships, of living that part of their life. And I can totally see why.
Yeah, within, from what is known within poly communities and non-monogamous communities associated with polyamory, etc., heterosexuality is actually a minority.
Yes.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Yeah. So this idea that polyamory is for straight men to get all the women, etc., etc., there's just no baseline in reality, because most of the polyamorous self-identified population is not constituted by men and is not even constituted by heterosexual people.
Oh, wow, that's really interesting. Yeah, to me it kind of makes sense that, as you were mentioning earlier, that the queers sort of from the get-go, they didn't have a script, they didn't have any role models, so they say, okay, like, if we can reinvent ourselves, not why not just do it from scratch and sort of question everything. So
and even the most known example, I mean, I think it comes from gay culture, which is the cruising scene. The cruising scene within the gay culture can be thought of, can be considered as a form of ethical non-monogamy, in a way, where the expectations and the way you behave are different from the heterosexual monogamous world.
When you live in a society that tells you that the only real relationship is the relationship between one man, one woman, and they're supposed to want to be stay together like this forever. Like, basically, that's what we teach our children from the first, like, fairy tales and the first Disney movies and whatever. You tell them the story that this is what you want to reach. This is happiness. Mm-hmm. Happiness is equals this one answer. We have pink,
you're pink.
Yeah, I was going to say Rosa Computanza, which is like the queer communities and Fries way of reaching out to society about, okay, let's have room for the gays in this picture as well. I would hope that let's have room for diversity, doesn't matter if it's relationship or it's sexual orientation or it's gender or whatever, let's just celebrate diversity, people.
And how do we do that without forgetting some people? Like, you become, as we discussed before, like, too focused on your own mission and then you forget whoever's left behind.
Well, there's a really interesting concept by a queer theorist called Paul Preciado. And Paul Preciado talks about queer multitudes. And for them, queer multitudes is this idea that people will just eventually come up with so many identities, so many perspectives, so many behaviors, so many words, that it will all just become a big, big mess. And that mess is called diversity.
Yeah.
I like that because I think that's what, like, I wanted to say normal people again, but, you know, conservative people, they're like, oh, there are just so many genders and labels these days. Like, what are they all talking about? But, like, that is sort of an act in itself to just be like, there's such a multitude, there's such just a spectrum that it's just, you know, everything.
To be very stereotypically academic, when you are classifying and when you are doing a taxonomy, you are always working on differences. This is different from that. A cat is different from a dog because of this, 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 mm-hmm. and that. If you explode the number of categories that you have, mm-hmm. if you're unable to perceive the differences because it's all just one big confusion, then the taxonomy breaks down. Then the normative systems start to break down because there's just too many words, there's just too many concepts, and you just go, okay, whatever, you do you, I'm gonna do me, and that's okay.
Yeah, you do you, because also, I guess, then you just also start seeing, like, combinations, like you're saying, okay, you can be polyamorous and asexual, and then you can be this and that, and then, oh, but then there's a continuum, gender is fluid, like, in the end, I guess it all just, like, explodes.
Well, that explosion is what I'm hoping for, you know. That's my goal. I don't want a society where everybody has to stand in line and wait their turn to be accepted, because we are equal enough to the picture of what the perfect person is. We are equal enough. We can be, like, accepted into that group, and then you have to wait, and then you have to wait, and then comes number 3,799 identity. Well, you have to wait a while because we are more important than you. Mm-hmm. I want us to get to that point where that bubble of what is normal explodes and out comes everybody, and everybody is equal, and everybody is valued for who they are. Like, you can do you, I can do me, he can do he, she can do she, and they can do they, and them can do them, and cats can be cats, and dogs can be dogs if they feel like it, and if a dog starts meowing, I'm happy for it.
Yeah, and until we get there, I just want to point out that it's still useful and it's still practical to use identities and to use specific words to stake out claims for specific rights, because I mean, we in our lives can sort of explode these categories, but that's not going to make the state let go of its power over our lives and over our rights. So we need to have also organized forms of political fighting that use some specific words to do some specific means. Mm-hmm. But, and here I'm resorting to another very famous feminist, Gayatri Spivak, a post-colonialist feminist, and she talks about strategic essentialism. And she talks about strategic essentialism, which is this strategy, obviously, this purposeful strategy of using a word as an identity to achieve certain political goals, and then just throw the word away. You just throw the identity away because you don't really think that it's something that is intrinsic. It's just a political tool for you to do something while you don't get to those queer multitudes.
Yeah, that's nice. Because I was also thinking about, because you were talking about that line, everyone's waiting in line, but then when people have these layers of identities, then they have to sort of choose, like, am I black, am I woman, am I queer, am I this, am I that, and then, you know, for those people, I guess it will be the most confusing.
We are all, okay, how I see people. I see people as this wonderful, wonderful mural of different colors, and all our little parts of our identity is one of those little glass pieces. One is pink, one is red, one is green, one is gray, one is this and one is the other. And if we show people that all these colors, the whole freaking rainbow and then some colors, are okay to be a part of who you are, then the one thing doesn't have to take power over the rest. For example, at this moment in my life, my poly piece is like really, really, really big. Because
your what?
My poly piece, the piece of my identity that is poly.
Oh, okay.
That part is like really, really big. And shoving off some of the other pieces of my identity in my fight to be like recognized as who I am. And if all the pieces are like there to pick and choose when you are like already, when you're a child and you can find you struggle to find your identity and you are presented with all the multitudes of colors, you can pick the colors that fits you best. And you don't have to have the feeling of that, well, at this moment in life, this part of my identity has to be shoved aside because I have to fight to have this identity piece. I have to really fight for this. And I think that will make people more at ease with just being themselves. Mm-hmm. So what I'm talking about, when I talk about relationship multitude, I talk about diversity. I talk about that I have this friend, which is like, she is the most mono person ever. She she has fallen in love with one person her entire life, and she ain't gonna stop. And she ain't gonna find somebody else, like, ever. They are not together. They will never be together. But she has found her love. She is like arc mono. And she is okay with that. Society tries to tell her, oh, you have to go move on, you have to move forward, you have to be like serial monogamous, you have to at least do that. But she's like, no, this is me. And my fight is as much for her right to do love her way as for a relationship anarchist's right to do love that person's way. Mm-hmm. So in my view, the important part is that you know why you are you, and that you know that this is me, this is my choice, this is my feelings, this is how I want to do my life, this is how I want to do love. And if you land on, I'm mono, yay for you, because you did it out of who you are, not out of society telling you how to do it. So I celebrate every person coming into themselves, that identity piece, if it's mono, if it's poly, if it's in any way poly, if it's this or that, I don't really care. I love the fact that you find you.
That's important.
There's something, what you said, I think basically relates back to the concept of intersectionality by Kimberlé Crenshaw. So we are all the things at the same time, and these identities intersect with one another and create structures of privilege and discrimination, etc. But the thing is, for you to do an intersectional analysis, you need to know what the variables are. And we are just now bringing attention to the fact that there is also this variable called relationship orientation or relationship configuration or relationship identity that is also a part of the intersection of who you are or who you might be at any given point, and that it intersects with everything else like gender, sexuality, etc., but is not the same as everything else.
Yes.
And I'm very curious about you, Lynn, because I met you yesterday and you're like just, I don't know how to describe you. You're so energetic, smiling all the time, so open to people. You're just like, oh, where did this person go? Hello, this and that. And I guess that's very brave considering that you probably face a lot of, what can I say, criticism or hates. Yeah, I guess you can call it that. So like how do you deal with that? And like this is more of a personal question, how do you deal with that and how do you stay so positive?
I think I was born positive. it's my default. Well, I have my darker moments. I definitely have my darker moments.
You shared with us something that you were on the cover of a newspaper and you didn't go out for 3 days. So
yes.
I guess we all relate to that somehow.
Yes, because I started out doing this like a really private person. Always like, I love people, but I also have social anxiety. So every day that I'm like doing social events like this and being that person you saw like, oh, I love you, I love you, I love you, because I do. I love everybody, almost everybody. There's a couple of people I don't care for too much, but there's not a lot of those. It results in me going home crashing, you know, because of my social anxiety part. I'm really scared that I will be too like into somebody's face at any given time. But
that's kind of your job, though, no?
Yes, this is my being me is my job. Kind of like being out there, being positive, being welcoming, being saying yes to people that wants a piece of me. That's my job. And then we have the personal me that is like really scared of people, but you don't see that as much. But I think that's how you do it. I do it because for every email I get and every like comment I get on the Facebook where with really aggressive and hate speech, I get people calling me, texting me, messaging me, coming up to me on the streets saying thank you for letting me be me. And I choke up every single time. I choke up. You know, it's like it's so big for me to know that I can do something for somebody to make them feel a little bit better about themselves and to help them come into themselves. It's so important to me. But yeah, I've had really, really bad days where I didn't want to get out of bed for like a week because of shit coming in my face, but then I get those other people pulling me up and saying we need you and you're doing great, and then I'm back on and then I'm there again. But it's not always fun.
No. I can't imagine. Daniel, do you relate to any of this? Do you get any form of criticism or more personal attacks on you as a private person, not you as an academic?
Well, actually, me as an academic also get attacked because of that. So if you're researching something within a given cultural context and that something is not seen as a serious subject, your identity as an academic and your respectability as a researcher also gets affected. So you're the one researching those strange things, researching those useless things, those pointless things. And so you might be respected for your work outside of your own country, and inside your own country, your colleagues laugh at you or laugh in your face because of the topic that you are researching.
Oh, wow. There was a guy who had been a sex worker and now was a professor and using his experience in sex work to write articles and papers about sex work, which I think, wow, it's so great, because for all the academics who write on this topic who don't have any experience, their research, I think, will be quite limited to those who have a more hands-on experience. So how do you relate to that? And like, does it get a bit murky academically that, like, you are not liable in some way?
Well, I think that academically, I do get some perspective on it. But the thing is, why would a monogamous person be more objective talking about non-monogamy than a non-monogamous person would be? Because they also have a perspective. There's this saying in science and technology studies and in epistemology of science studies that says that no knowledge is produced out of nowhere. We always produce knowledge, as Donna Haraway said, from a situatedness point of view. So we are always situated in some way. So as long as I take into account the situatedness of my own knowledge production, I'm as okay doing it as anyone else. Because if a monogamous person is working on non-monogamies, they don't feel the need to disclose their monogamous status to do research on non-monogamy. So why should I have to disclose my non-monogamous status? It's not about disclosure or non-disclosure. It's about how I situate myself before the field that I'm working with, and everybody is situated in some way towards every field of knowledge.
I would also say that the fact that you are thinking about this, the fact that you actually take this into consideration, makes your research more probably more correct because of the fact that you think about this, and people that are not in the non-monogamous world doing research on non-monogamy, they don't think about as much the fact that they bring into the table their feelings and who they are. They don't take that into consideration as much. And that would, your research therefore has the possibility to be more free of bias.
Yeah, or to take, I don't think the main goal is to be free of bias, because I think that some bias is inherent to knowledge production. I think it brings self-awareness, which is what you just said. It brings self-awareness into the research project. So I don't think that a monogamous person is better or worse at doing research about non-monogamy. I think that a less self-aware person is always worse than a non-self-aware person.
Yes. Yeah, that's a good point. And I think I wanted to ask you, Lynn, because you're a lot in the media. You're probably too. Because a lot of the time when I read the mainstream media interviewing, let's say, quirky people, I can see the prejudice in their questions. Like, they're maybe thinking that they are objective, but I can see in their phrasing how incredibly skeptical, in a negative, it's good to be critical, but just extremely biased and negative from the get-go. And how do you deal with that in the media? Because you want to be visible, you want to get the message out there, but if it's written in a, let's say, compromising way somehow, it's not that positive in the end.
Well, yes, that is something that I have come across a lot. Journalists saying, well, I'm neutral in this, and it's like, no, darling, you're not.
And even if they are, they have to sell newspapers, so they will put the sexy title like you were mentioning earlier.
Yes, it's like being in the media, I have had a lot of focus on being able to check whatever all the things they write about me before it's published. And what I don't have any control about is the desk, because who is making the headlines? They make the headlines they want. And a lot of the times I see headlines that are really sexualized, and the content is not. So so click.
That's pretty typical of media in general.
Yes, clickbait. But what I have noticed is that most journalists, I try and talk a little bit with them before they start the interview, so that they don't perceive me as this weird, sex-focused, sex-crazed person that really wants to, do weird stuff. And that they see me as a person, as who I am. And that helps a lot. But when it's like really quick meetings and things like that, I feel the aggressiveness sometimes from reporters. I feel the, oh, I don't like you, but I have to be nice to you.
Really? But so do you turn interviews down as well?
No, I don't. Oh. I don't. I always...
All publicity is good publicity.
Well, in one way, it's better for me to be forthcoming and to give them the best view of it as I can, and for them to try and pluck that apart and make it into something negative, than to be that person that says no, and then they can write, oh, but they are so close, they don't want to talk to us and things like that, because that can be easily negatively framed.
And also, I guess, as you said, as long as, because sometimes for me, just to know, to get to know the concept, even if it's framed negative, maybe I'm still curious and I will Google it or try to find people who are involved with whatever it is, and then you eventually get the truer picture of what, for example, polyamory is.
Yes, exactly. And every time I can get the word out there that we exist, you're not alone. Basically, that's what I'm saying every single time I'm doing an interview. This interview too. What I'm doing is saying to people, you are not alone. And that's my main message: you are not alone. And if that is heard in the Christian media, if that is heard in this or that, wherever it's heard, if it resonates with one person, just one person, that interview was worth it. So
yeah, we should close with that, like, you are not alone.
You're not alone.
thank you.
Du har hørt på Radio Rakel-dokumentar. Dette Sara Ammerdalen. Takk for at du hørte på denne miniserien om positiv seksualitet. Og husk, support your local radio.